And we are WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time. And if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab.
A great start to your day. We hope we can get you juiced to talking about art that we do every other Saturday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We hope you enjoyed Rise Up with Olivia and Becky. That is such a fun show. I just so enjoy that show. It's so upbeat and so exciting, and it'll be very much a contrast for our show today, Sheila, on the second show on the maladies of artists. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we're the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show.
Hi. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We have a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners. Tom and I are trying to demystify art, making your art adventure more enjoyable, richer, whatever you experience the visual. We try to bring art to light, unfolding into larger, brighter, more richly contoured surfaces, transforming vague awareness into definite knowledge. We also have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we've been talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. So please look at it if you can while you're listening. You can stream the program at TacomaRadio.org, and we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, and on ArtistExperience.com. You can listen at any time, and also the podcast can be found on iTunes.
Well, we promised a second show on the maladies of artists. There was so much to talk about in that first program, sorry. And we did the show about a month and a half ago, and we needed time for you to heal. So we're going to try our second show. And actually, we also have a third show on the maladies of artists. This program is about artists whose lives were cut short due to a host of situations, such as using toxic materials, visual artists and issues of mental health, debilitating diseases, and artists with a host of behaviors that cut their lives short. They made great art. And of course, no one will ever know what they would have made, of course, of their early passing. But they left a mark on the art world. And I think that's the important thing about this show. They left a real legacy. And we want to pay tribute to these artists. You know, artists live in finite time. And, you know, Sheila, maybe I'm just obsessive about this, that we have so much art to make as visual artists. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could think of like 150 years I need to create all the things that I want to create. But yet I know I live in finite time. And that's a heavy for very many artists. Yes. I mean, they're not just visual artists, musicians, so mm-hmm. on and so forth. So no one really knows what our time is. So this show will explore some very special artists and the contributions to their visual to the visual art in that the fact that their lives were cut short. Sheila, we talked about in our conversation outside of the radio at WOWD a lot about this. What about this notion about creating in finite time?
Well, in this show, we want to sort of show about artists that have struggled and struggled with mental health issues throughout their lives and the pressure of knowing that they're not going to get it all said, or they might, but then there's always the next time. And sometimes artists who live long have like multiple artists' lives, like they're able to switch from one place in their artistic lives to another, but a lot of artists don't get that time.
Right. So let's talk about that artistic legacy that we feel is so important to these artists we'll be talking about today.
Sure. Well, artistic legacy is the body of work an artist leaves behind that challenges the past, it advances the vision, and it opens new possibilities so that artists who come after them can stand on their shoulders and see the landscape ahead. There are so many good artists who make pretty, even beautiful work, and audiences are sometimes wowed by the technique that can make the new look old, especially. But a legacy that has the seed for expansion, that even a century later, the discoveries are so fresh that artists of the future can scoop it up and absorb it and add to the unknown and unseen. The artists we're discussing today, they are the giants of their times and perhaps of all times. No one could have done what they did, and their work was so distinctive that anyone who tries to imitate them will pale before them.
Right. Well, over the last 30 years, you know, artists have been much more responsible about the materials they use, hoping to be safer and less toxic. Various artists have a bit of different opinions on this. Some artists are a bit renegade in their use of dangerous materials in their, you know, expansive kind of vocabulary with media. And others are very strict on how they use it and why they use it. Traditionally, artist studios have not given the strict environmental rules from OSHA or any other governmental body dictating what can happen in a workplace. And I think that's a lot of issues with artists even today. Traditionally, artists just got a space, right? They found a space mm-hmm. and they just worked in it. And artists have been using many natural materials that have been safe, but then other natural materials that are very unsafe over the years. Firstly, there's flammable materials, and then there's heavy metals like lead, cobalt, magnesium, manganese, copper, and dangerous gases that get involved in the process, such as mercury, chlorine, and phosphorus. So there's a lot of different hosts of dangerous materials that in a lot of different art processes, and the chemical interactions with the bodies have often proved deleterious to the health. And we want to talk about some of these artists. And of course, then we have power tools, sharp tools that objects have used, chisels and things like that. There's all kinds of photographic processes that were dangerous, printmaking, plastics and resin. So we want to start the show with talking about some artists that unfortunately died young because of the materials they used. You know, I've been always fascinated by the death of Vermeer. There's a big cloud over that. You know, he died impoverished and all that. And yet, you know, he had to use like lead and cadmium yes. and manganese. And, you know, these are all toxic to the body. So like, yikes. Mm-hmm. And yet we really don't know exactly what he died for. Let's start off to a very with a very important artist that to both you and you and I, Sheila, Eva Hesse. And what about her short life and legacy?
Oh, I'd love to talk about Eva Hesse. She was a German-Jewish artist. She was born in 1936 in Germany. So that means that the war was beginning. And when she was three, she was sent with her sister to the children's transport. And she was sent to Holland. And when she was five, she and her sister were retrieved by her parents. And the family came to America. She was intelligent, curious, good-looking, very much loved, but she was consumed with a combination of drive and self-doubt. And sadly, her mother, who was probably bipolar, committed suicide when Eva was 10. When she was 16, she went to Pratt Institute, but she hated it, the kind of boxed-in teaching, first a still life with a lemon, then you got to add a loaf of bread, then you got to add a glass. So she quit, and she took the exam for Cooper Union, which she immediately loved. After Cooper Union, she went to Yale, where she continued to study painting, and she was Joseph Albers' teacher's pet.
Wow, that's pretty, very impressive.
Pretty amazing. He would say, "So, what has our Eva done today?" So she had a really wonderful education. She finished school in the 50s, where the art world was starting to radically shift, and Eva was amazing. She could draw and paint. She could, anything she did was just full of life and terrific. So she married the sculptor Tom Doyle, and they were part of the young New York art scene. So much experimentation was going on, and Tom got a commission to create a show in Germany. Eva was terrified to go back to her home country, but she was a wife, and because he was the artist, she fought through it, and she made art. She had the top floor of a warehouse, and there was a lot of leftover junk, so she started making sculptures. They were something of the same ideas that Calder had about three-dimensional paintings, taking things off the wall. And everything she touched was purposeful and logical and illogical at the same time. It wakes up your mind and your eyes. Eva was driven and uncertain, and when she wrote to her best friend, Solowit, he wrote back, basically, "Make bad art. Make silly art. Play, but just do it."
What a wise thing that
she told. What a wonderful thing to say.
That was wonderful.
Yes. Sure. What a friend. So when they came back to New York, it was the post-minimalist art era, and her marriage broke up, and she was in a frenzy to make her work. In a recent interview, Tom Doyle said, "She was high maintenance. I'll bet. She was one of the very few women to be admitted to the men's art scene. She was asked whether her art was feminine, and she said, art doesn't have a gender, but sensitivity might be a more of a female quality." I believe that.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah. She found a treasure of materials on Canal Street, rubber, washers, tubes, weights, plastic, and she found a guy, a fabricator from Staten Island, who was willing to experiment, to collaborate with her. She would make him a model of what she wanted, and he would find a way. Epoxy, silicone, polymer, fiberglass. It's the resins that are more dangerous when used in an unventilated or inadequately ventilated space, and the vapors and oil-based synthetic materials that went into making them are known to be hard on the respiratory tract, but relatively non-toxic. Otherwise, we really don't know. There's a question of whether this contributed to her brain tumor, which she developed in 1969. Her tumor developed so rapidly that there's really no proof, but she was handling everything, breathing everything. And it's clear from her belief of the impermanence of life and of art that she wouldn't have minded to die so young as long as she was able to make her work. She had 3 brain surgeries in a year, and she died at age 34. And the Guggenheim Museum held a retrospective that was completely filled with the work she had made in those last 5 years. So when she was lying in the hospital, she was shown the cover of Art Forum, and she was able to say, "That's me."
Wow. Well, we were starting off the show with the heavy, like we said it would be.
I know.
And this is an artist that we both really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. When I first saw her work and her drawings, I was really amazed. We're going to go back a few centuries and talk about the late colonial artist Raphael Peale, of the Peale artists' fame, of Charles Wilson Peale and Rembrandt Peale, and he was also a victim of his work in a very interesting way. Raphael Peale is often considered the first American professional still life painter, and he was dealing in realistic Trump loyal paintings. In other words, it looks so real, just like it is in scope and scale of the objects you paint. It's painting that fools the eye, and the viewer eats the subject right up. Fruits, vegetables, violins, but you can't eat those. But they're always beautiful. In addition to working on small paintings, Raphael Peel had a sideline of work as a taxidermist for his father. And I think that's an interesting thing. Well, yeah. Taxidermy, of course, is another art form. And more importantly, it deals with a host of materials that are very dangerous and highly toxic, like mercury and arsenic. And those are two troubling materials. Mm-hmm. In his early 30s, he began to experience some symptoms of arsenic and mercury poisoning that affected his digestive tract. There were a whole host of strange cures at that time. And one of them, for instance, was eating a lot of pickles. Eating pickled food, which I find very kind of sad, but delicious. Well, his symptoms and debilitating disease caused him to drink a whole lot as well, and that didn't contribute to his ills. And he died at age 51. There are theories that he might have been slowly poisoned with the arsenic and the mercury by a competitive brother in the art game. That's a real twist. Mm-hmm. At the end of his life, he experienced delirium and drunkenness, and all at that same point of being poisoned. All in all, it's a strange and sad story, but Raphael Peel's legacy in American still life paintings is secure, and there's some work here in D.C. by Raphael Peel. Yeah. He's an amazing artist. Oh. Tight. Very tight.
God, when I came to Washington, the first retrospective I saw was Raphael Peel, and it just blew my mind. I'm really working off that ever since, in a way. And he painted at a time when still life paintings were considered sort of the lesser of the painting genres.
True.
It was sort of fit for amateurs, and his paintings are masterpieces. It's also interesting to consider whether he used optical lenses in his work, since he was surrounded by science and his work is uncommonly accurate. But now I'm going to talk about Morris Lewis. Morris Lewis was a Washington color field abstract artist. He lived 50 short years, from 1912 to 1952. He graduated from the Maryland Institute of Fine and Applied Arts in Baltimore, and he was absolutely dedicated to being an artist, but his work was muddy and unremarkable. At this time, Baltimore's art community, including the Maryland Institute, was profoundly conservative in the 1930s and 40s. And when the Cohen sisters of Baltimore, encouraged by their friend Gertrude Stein, collected paintings by such artists as Picasso and Matisse, Baltimoreans were shocked by their acquisitions and considered the sisters more than a little eccentric. Amazing. So instructors at the Institute considered Cézanne's paintings subversive. While struggling as a student, Lewis also had to contend with family opposition. He had few friends, and he rarely discussed his art with anyone, not even his wife, who supported him for many years. He was never part of the New York art world, except for the few years he spent working at the WPA in New York during the 1930s. Instead, he chose the relative isolation of Baltimore and later Washington, D.C. The art critic Clement Greenberg introduced him to Franz Kline and Helen Frankenthaler and their paintings. Lewis clearly was ready for the eye-opening experience of that weekend, during which he also saw paintings by Jackson Pollock, probably for the first time in the original. The openness, energy, and expansive scale of Pollock's and Kline's work, as well as Frankenthaler's liberated techniques, staining raw canvas with thin paint, and her extension of Pollock's ideas, which is particularly notable in her masterpiece, Mountains and Sea, which is at the National Gallery. And when Lewis and Nolan saw them, they clearly, she freed them. So Morris Lewis, many believe, died from his liberal use of art materials, which I'll talk about. Lewis is very smart, and he was also a heavy smoker. So his studio in Washington was enclosed. It was actually his 12 by 14 foot dining room.
Wow. And he painted large, too.
Yes. But he took that staining method, which included very thin layers of paint on large canvases that appeared ghostly and transparent on the surface. He used an array of pure pigments, colors that were applied very meticulously in many layers to get the appropriate color combinations in the staining process. He didn't mix his colors. He stained them into the canvas so that the layers created the mixtures. I'm uncertain if he ever used paints thinned with turpentine or thinner. It's a little bit hard to find, nail that down, but the distillate materials are known carcinogens for now, for sure. And in the 1950s, they were not viewed as deadly like they are today. Artists used them very liberally. But by the 1940s, Leonard Brocourt, an American paint manufacturer, was working to perfect an acrylic paint suited to artists' needs. When turpentine or mineral spirits were used to dilute pigment, it left a halo on the canvas. So Lewis brought a jar of liquid that looked very much like honey, thick and viscous. Bacor mixed pigment into this acrylic resin and produced a paint that adhered well to both illustration board and paper. It dried quickly, and it left no halo. With further experiments, Bucour added the stabilizer best suited to hold pigment and resin in suspension. And by 1946, Bucour's acrylic resin paint, Magna, first appeared on the market. This is like Eva Hesse, a collaboration between the artist and the materials manufacturer, without whose inventions the work would not have been possible. It's like a musician who works with the instrument maker to get a certain sound. American painting in the 1960s, the first decade in which acrylic paints became the favored medium artist, is often termed color painting because of the greatly increased brilliance of the colors attainable with synthetic paints. As one writer explained, the transparency of the resin gives a quality of light refraction and reflection with the paints that provides a luminosity and a sense of depth unattainable in any other medium. The colors seem to glow from within. In fact, the acrylic resin used as the medium for Magna has a transparency clearer than all but the highest grade of optical glass. When used on unprimed canvas, which was Lewis's practice in the majority of his paintings, Magna penetrates the fabric and completely covers the fibers, thus further increasing the color's luminosity. When Leonard Bacor first saw Lewis's stripe paintings in 1961, he was overwhelmed by the artist's ability to maintain the equal intensity and saturation of each stripe along its entire length, a feat Bacor could not duplicate when testing the paints for these same qualities. He recalls asking Lewis how he achieved such results, to which the painter reportedly said, "You got something to say, you say it."
Very nice.
When I was in art school, I learned to paint and to smoke. The two go hand in hand. Look at the pictures of Renoir. Someone had to hand him his brush and someone to light his cigarette. We didn't know, but there was the romance of looking at art like we had TB. Or looking like we had TB. But now we know, and there's no excuse. We encourage our listeners to go online and see what the materials they are using to ensure their workspace is properly ventilated and has all the right tools to keep you working safely and creatively in your own artist studio. We think this is very important.
Yes, and I'll repeat it. We think this is really important. Yeah. And be very mindful of the materials you use and in the space that you work. I think these are really important nowadays. Well, many artists have recorded their art lives and the emotional states they've been in making art. And there are many, many writings about artists' state of minds from friends, colleagues, family members, and critics. Many months ago, we covered a story about artists in film, and many of them dealt with the unstable qualities of many of the famous visual artists. Well, sometimes these depictions take away from the art itself, and we kind of don't want to really talk about that, but there are several artists that had many critical circumstances in their lives, and they died young, but left a legacy and having mental health issues throughout their short careers, and we're going to talk about some of them. Sheila, why don't you start? Let's talk about Vincent van Gogh, that basically probably everyone knows, and Edvard Munch.
Yes. Being an artist, until recently, it's hard to fit into the world. Finding a means of support, money, understanding, the intense concentration it takes to do something that's never been done, to find that in yourself. Because of these genuine needs, it's easy to lose sight of your purpose. You'll find the word driven in our descriptions of these artists. The question of mental health, leading a balanced life, just might be the antithesis of true creativity. So Van Gogh is the prototype for the crazy artist. His ear, his shooting himself, his drunkenness, how he never sold a painting. Psychiatrists have posthumously diagnosed him with bipolar disorder, epilepsy, psychotic episodes, and delusions and depression. He was all of that, but his work was so extraordinary. His work spanned only 10 years. How could he have gone on, as they say now? He left it all on the floor. His paintings are alive with a spirit. He said everything he needed to say, and he left this earth at the age of 37, leaving behind a legacy that continues forever.
Absolutely. Van Gogh is kind of synonymous with great art. And there's so many new theories about the death of Van Gogh, which kind of even claim that he did not commit suicide by shooting mm-hmm. himself. Van Gogh mesmerizes us with his color, his power, his textures and patterns. He says it all in his drawings and paintings, and we all know that. Sheila, what about Edvard Munch, another interesting fellow?
Yeah, well, Munch was a Norwegian painter who lived from 1863 to 1944. When Munch was five, his mother and his sister died. His description of his father was that he was, quote, temperamentally nervous and obsessively religious to the point of psychoneurosis. From him, I inherited the seeds of madness. The angels of fear, sorrow, and death stood by my side since the day I was born. That's what Edvard Munch said. He said, I inherited two of mankind's most frightful enemies, the heritage of consumption and insanity. The subject for his paintings and prints was melancholy, illness, death, and terror, fear, menace, anxiety, or sexual intensity. Munch's self-destructive and erratic behavior involved him first with a violent quarrel with another artist and then with an accidental shooting, which injured two of his fingers. As time went on, Munch's anxiety, compounded by excessive drinking and brawling, had become acute. As he later wrote, my condition was verging on madness. It was touch and go. He was prone to hallucinations and feelings of persecution. His subjects were lovers, the sick child, melancholy, and especially on posters, neckties, plastic blow-up toys, handbags, and socks, the icon of modern art, The Scream.
Oh, the absolutely iconic painting mm-hmm. by Edvard Munch. He was also known to take his paintings out of his studio and just lay them outside in the landscape. In Norway, cold, freezing, snow, he would just leave them out there, and I'm sure his neighbors were very perplexed by that. Well, we've forewarned you that this show is very, very heavy, so we will need to take a station break as our listeners to hear some music to get them back on track for the second half of this intense material. So let's listen. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park 94.3 FM.
Well, we're going to continue our show with two artists that are probably not as familiar to a lot of our listeners. The first one is Nicholas de Stil von Holstein. This is a wonderful artist who had one tragic life, and he was born at the beginnings of World War I in 1914 to a Russian general and a Russian mother, but they were exiled to Poland at the time of the Russian Revolution in a somewhat turbulent time, and he was orphaned at age 8. But he was adopted by a very wealthy Russian entrepreneur, and they supported him, and he went to art school in Belgium, and he was very, very wealthy, and he traveled extensively to Morocco and elsewhere. Well, early in his career, he started really feverishly making a lot of work, but he would destroy it almost instantaneously. And then he married a French painter, Jeanine Julieu, who was also was part of the French art world, and they moved to Paris. And he began to get some recognition in Paris, and that was before World War II. So it's kind of a bad time for an artist at that time, World War II. He was not at the right time, at the right place. And he was served in the army, but he was discharged, and he settled in the south of France with his child and wife. And his wife did much to sacrifice her own career for him, but they lived in absolute poverty. And then the marriage broke up, and then he married another French woman, and here he was beginning to get hailed by critics in America, and this was a big step. And in 1952, at the age of 38, he hit the big time in America, and it allowed him to travel to France and Italy, and he saw a lot of powerful paintings and colorful paintings, but his work became more and more abstract with movement, color contrast, and a lot of his work is about space. I found his work very alive and moody.
Yes.
It's very a lot of high energy in his work. Well, he became successful. But as he became successful, ironically enough, he became more dissatisfied with his work. And he split from his family that was living in Paris, and he moved to Antibes, which is on the French Riviera, a very beautiful place. And he produced a lot of work. And then suddenly, out of the blue, he flung himself out of a building and committed suicide at the age of 40. And he was a powerhouse in abstract art, and an enigma to his own mental health crises remains. They have no idea what happened, but that was it for him. And it's a shame, because he was one heck of an artist in the early abstract movement. Another artist, Edvard Kischner, was one who experienced extreme mental strain throughout his life. He was a very sensitive artist, and he wrote a lot about his mental state, much like Edvard Munch, as we talked about before. And he was born in Bavaria in 1880, and he was a victim of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He lived between the two world wars, just like Nicholas de Stael. And he was definitely struggled with a lot of spiritual and emotional balance, and he wrote about this a lot. And he and his circle were progressively bohemian in a very conservative German society. And he had many relationships with his models and his partners, and it got him through this sense. And at age 25, he founded The Bridge, which was a group of German artists with Erich Heckel and Carl Schmidt-Rutloff, who were really good artists in their own right. And they began to forge the powerful German Expressionism movement. His work is very enigmatic, Kirchner's, with figures that are lengthened and awkward and very odd colors. His color combinations are very, very garish.
I love his work.
They're very unusual. Yeah. Well, his first misfortune was that he was drafted in World War I, and he suffered a mental breakdown. And between his breakdowns, he became addicted to a drug to help him sleep. That drug is called barbitol, and it's an early barbiturate that was invented to help people sleep that had been traumatized. And he abused alcohol with that drug, and he was a very heavy smoker. And it kind of went downhill from there. He recuperated, and he found a spiritual home in Davos, Switzerland. He really liked Switzerland and helped him out a lot. But he suffered other mental breakdowns as he began to work more and more feverishly. And he became isolated in Switzerland. And in World War II, the Nazis found his work, and they destroyed 600 canvases, and it was called the Degenerate Art of the Nazis as they rose to power. And that's enough to send anybody off, I mean, to destroy 600 canvases that they found of his. Well, this crushed him. And he was also stunned by the news he was hearing from Switzerland about the treatment of Jews back home during the turmoil. And he was a very sensitive guy, and this got him very upset. And feeling exiled and fragile, he couldn't do anything about it. He became more and more emotionally and mentally unstable. It was sort of like a roller coaster. And he committed suicide by shooting himself in front of his own house. His legacy was particularly important in America because he was really at the wave of expressionism as early as 1913, and his work was vaulted into America. Because the Nazis had destroyed his work, the Americans took up on this guy's work, and he became famous almost posthumously in America rather than in his own Germany, and that was one heck of a heavy research toll on me. Mm. It was a very upsetting researching Kirchner, who was an artist I always enjoyed.
Yeah, this is a difficult show, I think, emotionally for both of us, because it's so close. It feels so really personal.
And definitely personal in the next artist.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Gregory Gillespie. When I was in my first year in art school, there was this buzz, call it a buzz now, about Gregory Gillespie was coming back to school. And I caught a glimpse of him. I knew it had to be him because he was sure of himself. And he was good looking. And compared to the other guys who looked like dorks. But he was a year ahead of me. And he married Fran Cohen, who was in my class. And I'd known her briefly in art school. But later in San Francisco, we all became friends. Artists with babies and no money. We were trying to act normal, like normal parents, but we weren't. And we traded baby clothes and maternity clothes. And when they went to Italy on a Fulbright, we were sending stuff back and forth. And when they came back to the States, we visited on their farm in Massachusetts in the middle of the winter. By this time, they had two kids. They were both obsessed with painting and with showing their work. And I remember one of his collectors was the owner of Best Buy. And Gregory said he didn't want his work to be buried in private collections. He wanted museum walls. That is really something for me to hear.
Wow.
So the kids were pretty much sidelined. They sort of lived on their own while their parents were always painting. But Fran and Gregory were obsessed with each other, and not in a great way. They were into each other's everything. It was crazy. Like, Fran would cut up Gregory's food and put it on a fork and say, "Eat, Gregory, eat."
That's different.
When they came to visit us in Durham, a friend of mine met them, and she said, "Sheila, compared to them, we are Sears and Roebuck."
Oh, no.
Yes. And Gregory painted about 70 hours a week. He would smoke pot and concentrate on every single drop of water in his paintings. And he made a big success for himself, and he deserved it. His paintings were fabulous. They were dark, eerie. They were weird. And self-portraits with every magnified imperfection. His self-portraits tracked his life, every hair and pore. Gregory was really hot in the 70s, never part of any art world movement, but recognized on his own terms and in every museum collection. And when he was 40, he had a retrospective at the Hirshhorn. The women yelled out, "Gregory, you're wearing a suit." And then he went out of style. It happened. As time went on, he put less and less paint on the photographs he was using underneath his paintings, and Fran would nag him about that. Eventually, his marriage broke up, and Gregory came to visit us a couple of times. He was laughing about how all of us were getting older with liver problems. But he was a very generous guy, and he never, ever, ever acted in any self-important way. Later, he remarried and got into Buddhism and had a retrospective at MIT. And shortly after that, he hung himself in his studio when he was 64. No one expected it, even though he'd planned it out. And maybe the MIT show just finished him. Maybe the price his children paid for his neglect was unbearable. That's a possibility.
Yeah, there's some theories about his death and possibly prescription medicine complications and stuff like that. Well, he was certainly the rage in the 70s, mm-hmm. and I remember seeing his work. And I have to say, what really struck me about his work, which I really enjoyed for myself as a young artist in college as well, that he was very personal. It was mm-hmm. about his life on the canvas, and they were bold and honest. They were quirky and weird, and I really enjoyed that. Sheila, let's talk about a really amazing photographer. We have a couple of photographers coming up.
Sure. Well, Diane Arbus. She was an Upper West Side Jewish girl. She went to private schools, and her family owned Russick's department store. And she became a fashion photographer. She married Alan Arbus. And they did wonderful work as fashion photographers. But she became one of the most iconic photographers. Just say her name and close your eyes and see what pictures come to mind. The boy with the hand grenade in Central Park. Eddie, the Jewish giant with his parents in their Bronx apartment. Drag queens, a Mexican dwarf, triplets on their beds. Diane was fearless. She would take off with her cameras for some dicey place by herself to get those photographs, the priceless treasures she'd captured. There's no one and never will be anyone like her, not even close. Diane had two daughters from her marriage to Alan Arbus. Arbus is the best-known female photographer of her generation, and even with her ballsy independence, she developed a destructive dependency in her relationship with the art director and painter Marvin Israel that would last roughly for 10 years until the time of his death. He was married, and he made it clear to Diane that he was never going to leave his wife. The obsessive, self-indulgent, no-holds-barred quality of Diane Diane Arbus's life and the helpless, desperate nature of her death have led to the photographers being portrayed as a spectacularly flawed shooting star of the photographic history. She had violent mood changes, and when she was 48, she sank into despair and killed herself. Photographer Joe Meyerowitz said, "If she was doing the kind of work she was doing and photography wasn't enough to keep her alive, what hope do we have?"
Wow. Well, what a trailblazer in subject and orientation of her photos. I remember just being absolutely mesmerized by this vision that she had, and quirky and strange as it was beautiful. Well, another photographer who, in some ways, I see some similarities, was a young photographer named Francesca Woodman, who was a rising star in the world of photography. And she was born in Denver, Colorado in 1958. She went to the Rhode Island School of Design, and she was a star there and beyond. But her life was extremely short. Yet her works paved the way for many artists in self-inspection and psychological studies in photography. Much like Diane Arbus in some ways, but hers were a little more personal. Initially, her work was coming out of fashion photography, but she found no fortune in the fashion industry or no success. And she studied and went to Italy, and she was inspired by her Italian experience. She studied she photographed herself nude with clothing and kind of mixed kind of art that kind of was related to advertising and fine art. It was somewhere in a gray zone. And she kind of had a different focus from Cindy Sherman, who was also very self-introspective in her photography. But personally, she was a very assertive or possibly aggressive personality with great talent. She took failure and non-acceptance very hard. In her personal life, was in shambles. In around 1980, and the depression hit her very, very hard. Her disappointment for acceptance was partly fueled by not being able to win a grant or something like that. That's the rumor, and she was really heartbroken about that. And at age 22, now I'm going to repeat that: at age 22, she jumped to her death from a Manhattan building, and her legacy was started almost posthumously with many exhibitions that came out of her after her death. And she had a huge output of negatives and photography and all kinds of books that she did. Her work is regarded as very interesting and unusual. And in the late 1970s, 1980, which was 81, which was the year of her death.
And also, she was so destroyed by her lack of success, but we forget that at that time photography didn't quite come into its own as an art form. It was after.
Right. So, absolutely correct.
Yeah. So many artists' careers were cut short through accidents and unusual circumstances. Some artists' lives ended early in great mystery as well. We're going to take a look at some of the artists and their legacy. Of course, the shooting of Andy Warhol is probably the most famous of contemporary accidents. Andy Warhol, who can say? Is he a great artist? He certainly changed the conversation. He was a beautiful designer. He also caused art to be a commodity. I love him and I hate him, and his work is just so damn pretty. Well, he was at the top of his fame, which was both cultural and artistic. A woman named Valerie Solanas became obsessed with the idea that Andy Warhol would read and publish her book. And it was a manifesto. And she was pretty much stalking him. And he just blew her off. He had no sensitivity to her. And he just thought she was a pain. And so she came back and shot him. He never really recovered from that injury, and later he died after gallbladder surgery, which seemed a surprise. He was 58, but he had been in pain for years, and he was taking speed every day, working incessantly and hardly eating. His body just seemed to give up. Be careful how you treat your fans.
Yeah, well, you know, Andy Warhol was very introspective about the murder attempt on his life and the disfigurement of his body. He's been photographed.
Yes,
photographed in paintings of his body, and he was really scarred emotionally and very physically in a bad way. But there's also a little take on this, and he was, most of us probably don't know this, but he was a very religious guy, and he came from this Eastern Catholic Rite Christian background, and he was very kind of devout in a very secretive way. And he kind of rationalized this murder attempt as some kind of way to God, you know, punishing him for his lifestyle, partly because of his own homosexuality. And he was hanging around with a lot of people that, you know, drugs and cocaine at the time, Studio 54 scene. He not necessarily was taking those drugs, but he felt that this was like God's way of punishing him. And it was really very, very debilitating on him. And of course, the media definitely over-sensationalized that whole lifestyle that he had. So Andy Warhol had definitely had a cruel end. Mm. Well,
so I'm just going to mention David Smith, the sculptor. He was killed unexpectedly in a car crash when he was driving to my friend Marilyn's graduation party. He was 59 years old at the peak of his artistic career. His sculpture changed our landscape. It's all around Washington. You may not even know that who the artist was, but if you see his work, you will recognize it. And we all know about Jackson Pollock and his ascent to the art world post-World War II in New York City. And we discussed him and his wife, Lee Krasner, several times on the show. The film Pollock, about the late 1980s, which we all talked about as well, sadly depicted Pollock's bouts with alcoholism and his constant up and downs. He was addicted to alcohol, and he died at age 44 when he was driving drunk and he plowed into a tree, killing his current girlfriend and a friend of hers.
Well, that's mm-hmm. kind of a changed the whole art world in 1956. Well, there's so many more artists that we need to talk about in our next show, Maladies 3, which have to do with artists. And we're going to kind of cut it short a little here. And Sheila, why don't we talk a little about that life meaning that we have as artists that bring us to this conclusion of the show?
Sure. Well, being an artist is what gives my life meaning. I also have to mention my kids. I have to. But I can look at work I did 50 years ago and feel some pride. And friends that I have who are still artists after all this time, I think we agree that we've had privileged lives. I do have times of despair, but just indulge it for a day or two, because what else can I do? And there's always what I'm working on to see it through. I'm the worst homebody. Going with my kids and grandkids on vacation is difficult, but it's important. I think that the fact that I'm an artist is respected, though my work isn't much understood, despite my efforts to make it absolutely clear. This radio show for me is an attempt to communicate, not to feel so isolated.
The same for me, Sheila. Well, the artists we talked about, their corporal bodies are gone, but it's an important point to mention that there is a sense of immortality to them. Immortality is a state of being that many spiritual and religious journeys talk about. The fact that we can live beyond our time through the art that we make. Art defines culture and humanity and their role in creativity. All this left in the arts is that we do today will always be there in the future, whether it's a musical score, a sculpture, the poetic word, it survives, and that's a powerful thing. We invite you to experience the visual and experience art in everything you do, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. Sheila, talk about our upcoming show.
Sure. Well, Tom is going to go take a little vacation. What much,
very
much,
little.
Much earned vacation. So we have two programs coming up with my husband, Peter Blake, who will be subbing for Tom. And if you know, Peter also loves poetry, so we try to include poetry. And the first show we want to do is to explore the work of Sally Mann, a photographer who's having a retrospective at the National Gallery of Art.
Wow, how wonderful. I can't wait to listen.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, stay tuned to our exciting programs at WWD Tacoma Park. Coming up next, we have Bobby Hill with This Music. Bobby shares his incredible knowledge and music depth with this program on Saturdays, every Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. Our avant-garde jazz is right here, so keep that dial fixed. Thanks again, and we hope you enjoyed the show. Yeah.